At question number 3005, it's Ted Hitchcock Rip 4. Now, how did you settle into... I mean, you were still training when you first got to 226 Squadron, weren't you? From the looks of it, it's got various exercises. Well, one thing it mentions is formation flying. Was that a big thing? I mean, was that difficult to achieve?
Well, it was a big thing because all our most of our operations were done in formation.
Now that's different from the heavy bombers, a bomber.
Oh
flying,
yes,
they flew in a bomber stream.
They flew in a stream, and they did saturation bombing, but ours was pinpoint bombing.
Now tell me about the formation flying. What formation would you learn to fly in?
Well, three aircraft flying in together is known as a VIC. Six aircraft flying in formation is known as a box. And the box is built up in such a way as to offer the best resistance in the case of fighter attack. So number one's the leader. He controls the effort. Numbers two and three fly either side of him, slightly above him and slightly behind him. Number four flies underneath number one's tail, and numbers five and six fly slightly below number four and slightly behind. So looking at it from the side, you've got two and three, then one, then four, and then five and six. And you always turn into a fighter attack. So that you could, if necessary, you could bring all the guns to bear. And since a fighter has got fixed guns, he's got to aim in front of him. So if you're doing in a circle, he's got to do a smaller circle than you do.
So there's lots of formation flying down here. You also practicing cross-country flights. Do you remember the training cross-country flights? I mean, you wouldn't be that involved as navigator, I presume, but...
Well, no, but it was all training for the navigators and the pilots. And, and we used to play around with the radio as well.
Now, can you tell me about the wireless in the... the Boston. What wireless? Tell us what you were kitted out with. All the wireless gear you had.
Well, there was a small American set, but it had a receiver and a transmitter.
So this was not the type you were used to, and not a wireless.
Well, no, it was different, but you soon learnt to use it. And it was there. Contacted base when you took off and kept in touch.
Was it Morse or telephony?
Morse. You also had this TR-9 I was talking about, which was a set that you could speak up to about 10 miles.
Yeah, that as well.
Yeah.
Anything else? Any direction finding stuff?
No. No.
Now, so any other things? You seem to have gone on the sea search. I don't know what that was about. I don't know whether it's training or.
No, as a matter of fact, when the heavy boys had been out and there was a possibility of them somebody down in the sea, we used to go to look for them.
So you were looking for ditched crews?
Yeah.
You just fly low over the North Sea, I think?
Well, it's an exercise, and it's an organised exercise. You fly line abreast, six aircraft going line abreast, and then when you get to the far end, you drop a smoke bomb, and fly at the side of it, and you do a square search. And we used to get off an op for that. You didn't get an op for it, you got off an op, because there had been cases where Jerry had picked up the boys on the outside.
So it's not without risk?
Oh, no. But it wasn't appeared to be too bad.
You're also doing bombing. Now, was there any training in this precision bombing, Rob? Can you talk a bit about that? Did you do training in it?
Well, the navigators had a lot of practice at bombing. And when you realise that some of our targets were bridges, and when the bloke's got his thumb on the button to let the things go, he's got to do it just at the right second. Otherwise, you're miles away.
And how would you practice that sort of precision?
Well, we used to do the practice bombing ranges, which we used to go on.
And what height would you be doing this bombing from?
Well, it varied, but I mean, we used to fly normally between 8,000 and 13,000 feet. So you could, you could lay on, because there's so many things affect the bombs. There's the wind and whatever.
You seem to do your first real operation, if you see what I mean, on the 15th of October. A couple of sea searches, and then on 15th of October you do a raid on Le Havre, followed by another one on the 17th of October. Now, I wonder if we could use these to look at a typical raid. Do you remember these raids as raids, your first raid on Le Havre?
No, not really.
Can we look at a typical raid then? I think that's probably the best way to look at it. So, when would you first know you were going on a raid?
Well, this is a thing, you see, with two group. The battle order was published at 4 o'clock in an afternoon. And it was, that was up to you then. You were probably required in the ops room at 7 o'clock the next morning. So the first thing you got to decide is, how do I spend the evening? It's a long while from now to the ops room. And the last place to do it is in the bar.
So how would you spend the time?
Well, the navigator and myself used to spend a lot of time together. Very often we'd go out for a walk and just have the odd drink. Then you go back, you'd check in at the guard room for an early call, and then you go to bed. And we were in a room with quite a few other bots, and a lot of them weren't on ops. So they spent the night normally, so you couldn't be sure of getting a good night's sleep.
You mean they'd go out and have more than a drink or two? They'd have
if they weren't flying, that was it. But and then you'd put an early call in, and you'd be roused in the morning. And I always used to put an early call in about three quarters of an hour before I would do at the ops room, and go and have a good breakfast. Lots of the blokes didn't bother. They used to get nearly called straight down to the ops room.
Yeah. Why did you decide to have a good breakfast?
Well, the point was that by the time the other bods were having their breakfast, you could be shot down. Something could have happened, and you might as well have something in your stomach as not.
So it's just sense, common sense. Was it a special breakfast, you know, this air crew?
No.
It wasn't the bacon and eggs and things?
No, it was just an ordinary breakfast.
So after you'd have your breakfast, you get a call, you go to breakfast, then what?
Well, then there'd be transport to take you up to the ops room.
And where was the ops room?
Well, it all depended, but it wasn't far away. You could walk if you wanted to, but usually you'd get a call, transport, and they'd be there to take you along.
And would you get your briefing in the ops room?
Pardon?
Would you get your briefing in the ops room then?
Yes, that's what you went for, to know what exactly was going on. You went along to the ops room, and the first thing you saw when you got inside was the target. There'd be a blackboard there with the map and some grey wall around pins, and that showed you where the target was. You went in, and there'd be two or three SPs there.
SPs?
Yes, special police. There'd be one or two outside, but there'd be two or three inside at a table. And on this table were boxes, plastic boxes with your escape kit. And what you did, you collected a bag from the SP, and it was a numbered bag. And you were supposed to put everything in that bag that could be of help to the enemy if you were shot down. You tied the bag up, took it back to the SP, and he gave you your escape kit.
And what was your escape kit?
Well, it had got quite a lot of money in it. It had got quite a lot of barley sugar and various aids, compasses. Sometimes there was fishing tackle and whatnot in it. It wasn't very big, but it contained quite a lot of useful stuff. And you took that with you. Then you went and you were briefed and you were told exactly what you were doing.
Now, what sort of raid were you on? You're not going to the Ruhr and just flinging bombs out, are you? What are you doing exactly? What sort of raids were you on?
Well, bridges.
In France or in Germany? You reached Germany.
Well, for a start, a lot of them would be in France, but then we moved to France, so we went into Germany.
What sort of targets?
Well, there were things like bridges and Arnhem. We went to Arnhem.
Well, that's later.
Yeah, when we were moving, Arnhem was on, and we
that's nearly a year away. What about in the early days when you were bombing France?
Well, you can see what the targets are there. There was St Malo and whatnot. And they were probably...
Was it the port facilities or the submarine pens, or what was it?
Sorry?
Was it the port facilities or the submarine pens, or...?
Well, it could be anything. It could be anything if the powers that be thought that Jerry would be better off without them, then they'd send us out.
So you got told what the target... Anything else in the briefing? You told what the target was exactly?
Well, yes, and then whoever was in charge would tell you exactly what he was going to do. I mean, for a start, you set off from base and you'd say, right, we're going down to Portland Bill. We're going down at 1,000 feet. We shall pick up the fighter escort at Portland Bill and we shall drop down to 0 feet. Or sea level, or as one of the flight commanders used to call it, periscope height. And we should go across there just above the waves, hoping that if there are any fishing boats out with radios on, which there are, we should miss them, so that when we got to the coast, we'd get over there without any trouble. On the other hand, if they picked us up, then they'd start firing as soon as you got within range. This could happen. And it was up to the leader then what sort of evasive action he took. I mean, there's two types of heavy bomb. There's visual, and there's predictive. If it's visual,
it's flak you're talking about.
I'm talking about heavy flak. If it's visual, there's a fellow on the ground and he's giving the gunners corrections from where the bursts are. if it's predicted, it's a different story.
So they're just firing based on where a machine has told them that the machine.
Well, yeah, yes. But
so you'd be briefed on all that sort of thing?
Pardon?
You'd be briefed on the type of flak to expect?
Well, you don't know. I mean, this is one of the things of experience, because in the case of predicted flak...
We'll come back to this, because we're not there yet. We're in the briefing at the minute. Anything else to tell you in the briefing?
No. Well, you get weather reports and all the rest of it.
So how long would a briefing last about?
Half an hour.
Were you briefed as a gunner or just as a crew?
No, it's a general briefing.
And there wouldn't be a gunner's briefing or a pilot's briefing after as well?
No.
So after the briefing, what then?
Well, that's it. Out to the aircraft and away.
So how would you get to the aircraft? Would you get
There's always transport laid on.
And what was the procedure? What would you have to check before, you know, you get to the aircraft?
Yeah.
And is it handed over to you by the ground crew? What's the sort of procedure before you take the aircraft up?
Well, you make sure that everything you want is there. I mean, you do a firing burst with the guns when you get out to sea, but you can't do that before you get out to sea.
So you just have a look and check it?
Well, you just have a look and make sure everything's all right.
What about the wireless? Would you check that?
Well, no, because you keep radio silence. Keep radio silence.
So what about anything else before you take off?
No, I don't think so.
Did you have any superstitions in your crew? You know, some of them wore things, carried things, urinated on the wheel, all sorts of different stuff. Did you have any superstitions?
No, not really, no.
You weren't superstitious then?
No, I was at one time, a little bit, because my dad gave me it was a threatening bit, actually, with it. This had been drilled. And I had it hanging on my flying helmet. And somebody pinched my helmet. And I did worry for a couple of trips, because I hadn't got this little charm with me. But anyway.
So what about takeover? What about getting in? You get in the aircraft.
Yeah.
And then check everything. And then what about takeoff procedure? How would it take off? Any order? Would you take off in formation, or would you know?
We usually used to take off two aircraft at a time. And then some flight commanders would circle the drome and form up. But others would say, set course. We'll set course and form up in loose formation. And you used to keep loose formation until you were ready for bombing.
So you'd fly in loose formation.
Well, yes, it was so much easier for the pilot, you see. And we used to fly very close, normally, for bombing.
I'll come back to that. So you flew out. Now, what would you be doing as you're flying out, as wireless operator gunner? What were your duties in the plane on the way out?
On the way out was listening out for any alterations.
So you were monitoring the wireless?
Well, they were listening out. There were six of you doing that anyway, so.
And that would be things like cancellations or changes in plan?
Yeah.
So you'd just be listening to us. Was it a set frequency?
Well, yes. I mean, you were on base unless anything else happened, but you were listening through on base. But you could alter your frequency. You could alter it any time.
But you didn't send. You maintained wireless. Tell me about a bit more about wireless sounds, because you didn't send any messages, did you?
No.
No. That's strictly enforced.
No, but it's. I suppose it's sensible, really. I mean, normally, when you contact base, you tell them that you're airborne and ask for a time check or something. Well, if you're getting a dozen aircraft doing that, obviously Jerry's listening out and he's going to know something's on. So you keep silence.
In what circumstances would you send a message then?
Pardon?
When would you send a message?
Well, you'd send a message on your way back if somebody had gone down.
So that would be the kind of message. So it's only a real emergency. What about the intercom? What intercom system did you have?
Well, the intercom's good.
How did it work? Was that in your helmet?
Yes, it was good. I mean, you could talk to one another all the time.
And did you, or did, because some skippers had intercom silence as well, do you know what I mean, as well as wireless silence. Did you chat to each other?
Yes, oh yes.
What would you chat about? Or would it just be business?
Anything. I mean, we're a good crew.
And what was your flying kit? What would you actually wear? Almost from underpants up. I think you see what I mean. Because people don't know what the flying kit was now.
Well, I've got some photographs there.
But they can't see me, but when they listen to the tape, what exactly would you wear?
I always wore the issue was an undersuit and a flying suit, which the heavy boys used to use because it was cold. But I always used to wear the inner suit because when they opened the bomb doors, it was very drafty at the back there. It was cold. And especially if you're at 13th hour. But Reg, navigator, he just wore my West, of course. But the skipper and the navigator just wore normal clothes. Tom did in the back.
So you wore a suit?
Well, I wore this inner suit because... As I say, there were times when the...
You wore that on top of your uniform?
Yes.
And then what about your hands? Any gloves?
And about...
On your hands?
Finger ends?
What, hands generally? I mean,
we had gloves. You'd got three pairs. You'd got a very thin silk glove. For feeling, and you'd got a woolen glove, and then you'd got your ordinary leather gloves, and well, they'd keep you warm, all right.
And you had the helmet on, and that had the intercom, and did you have oxygen in there as well?
You had an oxygen mask, yes, and we always wore that 10,000 feet or more.
Would you have it on normally?
No, but the thing is that the oxygen mask has got the microphone in it. So, normally it hung loose. But when you wanted oxygen, you just clipped it on. And And that was it, but it paid you to use oxygen at any height.
Now, so you're flying that. Would you be constantly vigilant as on the gun as well? Would you be looking around, or would you just be on the wireless?
Well, in the Boston, I was the wireless operator gunner. So it was up to me to look out for anything or not.
So how would you look out? Could you do that while you were on the wireless?
Well, no. And then in the Boston, of course, you could be on the wireless and keep a lookout as well because they were very close. But in the Mitchell, Tom was in the turret.
This is the Boston turret.
Yeah. Well, yes, you could... You could listen out and you could look out as well, yes.
And you keep a constant lookout then, all the way over?
Well, yes, you're supposed to, let's say that. And it pays you too.
So you keep your eyes open?
Yes, yeah.
What would happen as you approach the target? Would you tighten in, the formation would tighten, would it?
Yes, yes.
And at what point would you do that? When you went over the coast or what?
Well, no, because normally you'd fly in open formation till you got more or less to your bombing run. And then you'd close up for your bombing run.
Now, what about the approach to the target? What about the flak? Would you get the flak mainly over the target, or would you get it anywhere else?
Oh, you very often, if the gunboats picked you up, or the fishing boats picked you up, and they were on the radio, they'd start to fire at you before you got over the coast, before you approached the coast.
And what was it like under anti-aircraft fire? Because people can't imagine it now.
Well, let's see. Difficult to say, but it's not very pleasant. And there's one thing that you do that's there all the time is the fact that flak, it takes, if the aircraft is turning, it takes 3 minutes, 3 seconds to predict a turn. But it takes 10 seconds to predict a change of height. That's why you never fly straight and level over enemy territory in daylight. You do a corkscrew. But it takes 10 seconds to put a turn right. But your bombing run takes you about 15 seconds. So if you're that way inclined, you think about that. You're flying straight and level for 15 seconds.
Now, what was the bombing run like?
And it all depends. Some were rough. The flak, if there was a lot of it, it was a bit naughty for a time. And it all depended. I could tell you one story about Venlo.
We'll come to that later. That's a bit later.
But
we will do the individual stories. It's just sort of a typical one, you know.
Yeah.
So you'd have to fly straight and level during the bombing run?
Yes.
For about 15 seconds?
About 15 seconds it took. And that's when it was most dangerous, I suppose.
Now, how nervous did you get? It's always difficult. I mean, did you get scared or were you okay? How did you feel?
I've been scared many a time.
Was that when it was worse?
Well, yes, but the thing is that you've got a job to do. I mean, it's a different life altogether. It really is. It's a different life altogether. And you can... you more or less get used to it. I mean, I've had breakfast with blokes in the morning, and in the afternoon I've spent sorting the kit out. And, it's something... It's difficult to explain, but it's just a different life altogether.
So you got nervous, but you kept going.
Well, yes, because you've got a job to do, and in actual fact, the other bods were more important than you were. That should be your attitude.